Chapter 5. Stage 2. Disconnected and Disengaged. The essence of Stage 2 is my life sucks, and it accounts for 25% of workplace cultures. People at this stage feel they're victims of circumstance, and there's no way to get traction for their ideas or ambition. When they're presented with new visions, their reaction is, we tried that before, didn't work then, won't work now. They tend to be passive, doing the minimum amount of work to get by. It's easy to spot Stage 2 from the outside. To see it, we only have to look at the organizations most of us love to hate. The Department of Motor Vehicles, doctor's offices that make us wait 45 minutes reading magazines older than we are, while the receptionist moves so slowly we wonder if she may have died. Travelers all scratch their heads as security screeners sit around talking, while the line stretches out the terminal door, the workers apparently oblivious that people are about to miss their flights. From an outsider's perspective, the two questions people ask, often with anger in their voice, are these. Why doesn't anyone do something about this situation? And how can people be so stupid? As one person asked me on a recent flight, as the flight attendants forgot to offer beverages, how can people be that stupid and still live? I mean, their brains at least remember how to make their heart beat, right? Doing something about Stage 2 is difficult. Most managers are trained to utilize techniques that not only don't advance people, but hold them at this zone of apathy. As a result, Stage 2 is the second most common we find in organizations, after Stage 3. We've seen Stage 2 in the highest levels of government in Washington, D.C., among bank executives in Asia, on boards of directors of Fortune 500 companies, in Italian cathedrals, in the halls of companies praised as America's best places to work. Overall, about 25% of workplace tribes are dominant Stage 2, and the percentage goes up when organizations hit major obstacles, like a recession, falling reimbursement rates in healthcare, tight competition among the airlines, or increasing competition for manufacturers based in the United States. We see Stage 2 mostly when people believe they cannot act creatively, where jobs are so mechanized that they feel like part of a machine. We've seen vibrant organizations, Stages 4 and 5, devolve into canyons of bureaucracy. As a result, tribes drop from Stage 4 to 3 to 2. Stage 2. A view from the inside. Stage 2 and Stage 3 need each other. Roger's story shows the dynamic. It was early Friday when Roger boarded a plane from Chicago to the West Coast, where he worked as a manager for a major high technology company. He was tired from running focus groups the night before, gauging the likely reaction to his company's upcoming product launch. When he landed and got to his car, he checked his voicemail. 5 messages. That's odd for a Friday morning, he thought. The first was from one of the company's attorneys, who said that there was a potential lawsuit alleging that one of Roger's products violated a copyright of a competitor. The second and third messages were panicked calls from one of Roger's team members, ending with, "This is getting big fast. Get back here now." The fourth message was from the attorney again, this time on a speakerphone. "The general counsel of the company is waiting to see you," he said. His tone was different. Roger told us later, "It was like we had never met before." He added, "It was clear to me that the general counsel, known as the tiger in the office, was standing over his shoulder. This is someone I had never seen in the office, and the lore is if the tiger ever wants to see you, it's really, really bad for you." We should add here that the names in the story have been changed, but every other detail is exactly as it happened. The next message was from Roger's boss, Todd, who yelled, "The tiger wants to see you. What's going on here? And where are you?" As with the attorney, Todd's tone was as though they had never met. "Finally, Todd arrived," Roger tells the story. "I show up at the office, and I'm tired, dirty from travel. I round the corner, and I see Todd's assistant waiting outside my office. She said, 'Wait out in the hall. I need to go get Todd.' I had just enough time to peek in my office, and everything I had was in boxes. Even the pictures were taken off the wall and wrapped up. I said, "Oh my God." Todd marches in and says, "They're waiting for you downstairs in legal." I asked if I could put my stuff down, and he said, "No, let's go now." I pointed to my office and said, "Really?" I couldn't believe it. I said, "Todd, 3 years, and it comes down to this? Really?" By now, a crowd is gathering. Members of my team look scared. Todd has already turned and is 10 steps ahead of me walking down the hall. "Are you sure?" I couldn't believe it. His assistant grabs my arm and escorts me behind Todd. It was like security leading me from the building. We get about 15 steps and Todd turns to me and says, "Ah, gotcha!" He high-fives his assistant, who looks apologetic, and then shouts, "That was money!" People in Roger's team were looking away. Roger asked, "So the whole thing was a joke?" Todd answered, "That you're fired? Yes, well, at least for now. But legal really does want to see you, and this copyright issue is getting ugly fast. Come on, they're waiting for us." Todd led Roger to the Tiger's office. After a 2-hour meeting, which Roger describes as an interrogation, he unpacked his office and went home, took a nap, and spent the afternoon working out his rage on the tennis court. The effects of bosses like Roger's are devastating to a culture. Their actions have the same effect as an earthquake or a bomb going off. People scatter. They dive under their desks. Some leave the building and don't come back. After the emergency is over, they check in on one another, treat the wounded, mourn the dead, and go on, living with the knowledge that it will happen again. Not surprisingly, a lot of energy is spent in quiet protest of the boss and the company that permits, even seems to encourage, from the perspective of the employees, random acts of ruthlessness. The culture that forms as a result is the essence of stage two. People's words express that they are victims, powerless. Their life sucks, they say. Not life itself, which is stage one, but their life. They can see that the boss's life is good. They see their bosses as Teflon characters, for whom no misdeed is punished. Roger's vice president in this story drove a Porsche, made a lot of money, was respected in his industry, and often took calls from headhunters. Someone who works for a boss like Todd, who is typical of stage three, "I'm great and you're not," has a choice: fight the boss or give in. The person who fights it moves to stage three, and the battle for supremacy begins, like dogs fighting for alpha status. For Roger, this move would have cost him what he wanted most: his first big promotion after getting his MBA from Kellogg at Northwestern. If he left before getting the brand manager title, he would lose career momentum. The choice Roger made, as he told us, was to suck it up. Although still intelligent and ambitious, he temporarily became a lapdog, his words, to get what he wanted. In the meantime, he disconnected from his passion and put up with the nonsense. Many people in Roger's situation do put up with it until they're promoted, and then they find themselves the victim of another set of circumstances, the next boss. This pattern can continue for an entire career, and we've seen some CEOs, happily, not most, firmly planted at stage two, complaining that they couldn't implement the right directives because the board of directors wouldn't let them. As long as people are in stage two, they believe their destiny is not their own. As a result, they often avoid accountability. People tend to use phrases like, "I'll try," "I can't promise." "I'm not sure what the boss will say about that." "That's not possible." "We can't do that." "It's against policy." And, "I can't make someone else do their job." Physicists define power as the time rate of work. In that sense, the stage two language screen nets out to, "My words are not powerful, because even though I gripe all day, nothing changes." The language system of stage two also deflects core values. When we ask people at this stage what principles guide their lives, we heard a sort of pseudo-wisdom. In the words of one manager at a public utility, I thought values were important once too, but I came to see that sort of talk just disappoints you in the end. Stage 2 has an ineffective relationship with values that comes across as cynicism, sarcasm, or resignation. Most, like Roger, eventually advance to Stage 3, where they become the same sort of manager they hated. As we'll see in the next two chapters, they don't need to stay at this stage for long. In the meantime, they tend to join forces with others who feel disconnected, and a Stage 2 culture forms. Most represent what our colleague Scott Weiner, a CFO in healthcare, calls the entrenched mediocrity. At the very end of Stage 2 is where Roger went, a group of people all vying for promotion, putting up with the nonsense until they can get themselves out. When people cluster into Stage 2, their discussions often focus on how they're being screwed by management or the system. Unlike the people we met in the previous chapter, their beef is with their life and with the people they see are to blame for their lot, not with life in general. They can see that their lives could work out, while Stage 1 sees only continued despair. Unlike these later stage tribes, Stage 2s are united in their belief that someone or something is holding them down, standing in their way. It might be the boss, the system, their lack of education, or their belief that mom or dad didn't raise them to be competitive. The key is that they accept this obstacle as the way it is and the way it will always be. They give up and they band together in a kind of support group for the oppressed. The most usual suspect is the boss, and one of the hallmarks of Stage 2 is Dilbert cartoons on cubicle walls, taped on the coffee machine, even hanging from the leaves of plastic office plants. In a sense, Dilbert creator Scott Adams has become the spokesperson for people whose lives suck because, in their view, they work for an ass. Dilbert, a cartoonish parody, is uncomfortably accurate for what 25% of professionals in the United States experience in their everyday workplace. Making fun of bad bosses, idiot bosses in Dilbertese, is Adams' stock in trade. And from our research, constitutes a lot of how people in Stage 2 spend much of their time. Because Stage 2 discussions often resolve down to, "My boss is making my life suck," we couldn't think of anyone better than Adams to explain the mindset from the inside. We interviewed Adams about why so many people are unhappy at work and why they can't do anything about it. He told us, "Idiot bosses are built into the system. If you hire somebody who truly cared about the employees, they would be completely ineffective as a leader. You'd be saying stuff like, 'Well, we couldn't get the profits because we didn't want to miss our kids' Little League games. Why don't we just push the deadline out a little bit?'" He continued, "As soon as the employee smelled weakness, everybody would have a dead relative they'd have to go to a funeral for. There's a level of toughness and coldness and evil that is required. The system breaks down if you don't have that." The word "evil" is carefully chosen, as Adams pointed out when we asked what kind of boss Dilbert would be. He answered, "He'd be a poor boss, because I've often said that leadership requires a deep and innate sense of evil. If you think about it, the whole point of leadership is to get people to do things they don't want to do on their own. So, for example, you don't need a leader to say, 'Eat this bowl of delicious cookies.'" Adams continues, "But what about, 'I'd like you to work on the weekend instead of seeing your family, because I'll get a big bonus when you're done.' It's just pure evil," he said. He continued, "You're trying to get people to do things that aren't in their best interest, and they know on some level it's not in their best interest. But using your leaderly skills and your Rasputin-like ability to get people to do what you want, they'll do it anyway. The essence of leadership is getting people to do things that they know isn't in their self-interest." Adams has created a perfect parody of Stage 3, and he's made it seem obvious why Stage 2 cultures form as a reaction to "I'm great and you're not," the mantra of Stage 3 bosses. He also helps answer a question that people at later stages often ask about those who work for stage 3 bosses. If your boss is such an idiot, why don't you go to work somewhere else? Adams answered the question this way. I worked at Crocker Bank in San Francisco, and I thought that things happening in that big company couldn't be happening in other big companies. It must be something deeply defective about the one place I chose to work. Then I changed jobs, and the acronyms changed, and the buildings changed, but all the other stuff that bothered me was eerily similar. A lot of people wrote to me when Dilbert first started, he added, saying I had cut down on their desire to change jobs because they could see it must be the same everywhere. Adams contends that this growing awareness that evil bosses are everywhere led to an acceptance that organizations are just ineffective and that evil bosses are part of corporate DNA. We should note that we don't use words like evil to describe any aspect of any stage. In fairness, we believe Adams was using this word for dramatic effect. The problem with words like bad, evil, and wrong is that when they're used as labels, the person can't escape from them. The trap of stage 2. While stage 2 often forms in response to evil bosses, it forms for lots of other reasons as well. In our research, people blamed lack of education, poor social networks, lack of political skill, an inability to think strategically, or an unsupportive spouse who wouldn't let them work the extra hours required for success. For many people in stage 2, their residence at "My Life Sucks" seems immune to getting rid of the subject of their complaints. If managers fix what they snarl about, they go out and get more reasons to be unhappy. People in our studies did complain about idiot bosses, but also about the name of the company. It took too long to type out in emails. The temperature at 72 degrees, just too hot. The printer that took forever, actually 10 seconds, from the time they hit Control P until they had the hard copy. Even though we were just gathering data, we found that our own mood fell to "my life sucks" when we spent time hearing about why people's lives suck. We felt we were being pulled into stage 2, right along with the complainers. "My coworker has BO," we heard. "Then tell him to get right guard," we thought. "My boss is mean to my friend," people said, making us wonder, "and this is your problem because..." "The floor is too slippery," we heard. "That's why they call it wax," we thought. The more we heard gripes, the more our lives sucked for having to hear them. The truth is that no one is immune to the siren song of stage 2, not even people collecting data on it. So, what's going on here, we wondered. Not only do some people appear complaint addicted, but they also seem miserable about it. As we fell down the stage 2 well, one manager asked what he could do, and we suggested putting Prozac in the water cooler. We later apologized, even though the manager thought it was funny. The fact is that stage 2 wants to avoid accountability at all costs and will invent reasons to remain disconnected and disengaged. In our public seminars, we've developed a method to show people how quickly stage 2 can form. We'll often say, "I'll tell you why my life sucks, and then you have to do the same." We start, "My life sucks because I have to be here with all of you." At first, stunned silence fills the room. People look around, reach for their water glasses, or try to look distracted by noticing the design of the carpet, that same flower design that haunts the dreams of people on the speaking circuit. Someone will say, "Well, my life sucks because I have to listen to you." Nervous giggles bubble up, followed by the awkward silence. "Who said that?" Will ask. No one volunteers, except on occasion, people around him pointing their finger in the guilty person's direction. Will ask, "Whose life sucks more than his?" "My life sucks because I drove 3 hours to get here, and I have to listen to this drivel," someone will say, usually laughing. Laughter floats up again, this time lasting longer. "My life sucks because my mom lives with us. My life sucks because my boss is here, so I can't say how much he sucks." My life sucks because I have 3 kids in private school. My life sucks because my company just changed its healthcare plan again. The comments come faster and faster. The laughter gets louder and louder. Finally, the whole room gets going. Depending on the type of group, doctors are polite, salespeople aren't. The room will become so boisterous that we have to unclip our lapel mics, move them an inch from our faces, and yell, "Okay, come back." Before order resumes, the bitching continues. My life sucks because I have to do 80 hours a year of training. My life sucks because I have 200 unread email messages. Almost every time, as if scripted, someone will end the gripe fest by saying, "My life sucks because this discussion is what my job is like every day." No matter how educated, successful, talented, ambitious, or enlightened you are, we are, stage two is like a trap waiting to snap shut. It starts with one gripe, then another. Soon everyone says only negative comments. The cycle amplifies as the entire group joins in. In our sessions, people's laughter is a positive reinforcement that keeps it running. In work tribes, the discussion is often somber, the mood like a movie when the hero has discovered a conspiracy so vast it is unstoppable. We heard comments like, "They're reducing our benefits," and "They're cutting the subsidies at the cafeteria." Those were followed with, "It won't be long until they start to move our jobs to India," and "I heard the board has decided to close us down." Dominant stage two cultures all seem to have wise people appointed by the culture, never by management. One of our clients calls them keepers of the sacred flame of no accountability. In a large nonprofit organization where one of us worked, we overheard a seasoned employee giving advice to a young recruit. The older man said, "Don't try too hard. It only raises expectations." The key word here is pretend. Pretend you're overworked and no one will bother you. Pretend it's someone else's fault and you get to do what you want. Pretend you're waiting on another department and you'll get praised at raise time. Stage two soaks in this culture of accountability avoidance and complaint generation. As a result, managers who attempt to earn trust by fixing what bothers people feel that their energy is being drained by a cultural vampire. The needs are endless, the complaints inexhaustible, and in the end, most managers give in to the inevitable and assume this is all people are capable of doing. Coaching advancement. There are 3 keys to nudging people out of stage two. First, communicate only one stage above. This principle holds for all 5 stages, except 5, which we'll discuss in a later chapter. In the case of a stage two tribe, leaders should talk the language of stage three, which is, "I'm great." Second, spot and work with the few members of stage two who want things to be different, and work with them one-on-one. Start by explaining to each one that you see potential in him, that you want to assist him in developing leadership. Depending on how long he's been in stage two, he may have developed an immunity to praise, believing it to be a technique of manipulation. Your goal is to both build trust in your intentions and confidence in his abilities. As you start this process, you will become the person's lifeline into stage three. That is, he is great because you are mentoring him. If you cut the lifeline too early by stopping the personal attention, he's in danger of regressing to stage two, and this time lapsing into deep cynicism. Spend your time pointing out the things he does well and directing him with specific action, all in the context of developing his abilities. The third leverage point is to encourage him to form dyadic, that is, two-person relationships. In our research, we often ask people to draw out the network of their relationships at work, using thick lines for strong ties, thin lines for what we called minor friendships, and dotted lines to represent information exchange. People at stage two tended to have mostly thin and dotted line relationships, and not many of either. People at stage three, however, formed hub-and-spoke networks, with themselves always at the center. Leverage points for stage two. 1. Encourage her to make a friend, then another friend, then another friend. In other words, encourage her to establish dyadic or two-person relationships. 2. Encourage her to establish relationships with people who are at stage three. Such individuals can be identified by their eagerness to mentor others into becoming mini versions of themselves. However, the same individuals will not tolerate another becoming greater than they are. 3. In one-on-one sessions, show how her work does make an impact. In particular, show her areas where she's competent, where her strengths are. In the same meeting, point out abilities she has that she has not yet developed, but be careful to make the tone of these discussions positive. 4. Assign her projects that she can do well in a short time. These assignments should not require excessive follow-up or nagging, as this behavior may reinforce her "my life sucks" language. Success indicators. 1. She will use "I'm great" language as opposed to saying "my life sucks." She may name drop, point to her own accomplishments, and brag. Many of her sentences will start with "I." 2. She will exhibit the lone warrior spirit of stage 3, often comparing herself with her coworkers and using disparaging language like "what's wrong with them?" and "if they tried, they'd succeed."